The Path to Authenticity is brought to you by GIA Miami. Founded by world-class mental health experts, GIA provides advanced care for difficult-to-treat conditions, including anxiety, medication-resistant depression, and obsessive-compulsive disorder. Using state-of-the-art methods, GIA can help people recover from conditions when more traditional approaches can't. Dr. Antonello Bonci has assembled an expert team serving international clientele in a modern and resplendent Miami setting. If you or someone you love is suffering from depression, anxiety, OCD, or other mental health concerns, call GIA at 833-713-0828. You can learn more about GIA by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting GIAMiami.com.
Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I am Amy Effman, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity, episode 208 for January 24th, 2023. I finally managed to import the email addresses for those of you who subscribe to the Path to Authenticity newsletter, so you'll now be receiving emails from my Substack publication, The Manifest. If you're not already subscribing, I'll leave a link in the show notes. Please do so. I'm sending out a little message every Monday, a little inspirational thing, and then an essay on Fridays. And as time goes on, I'll be doing more. Please check it out. I appreciate your support. This episode features a friend and colleague, Amy Effman. She's a therapist practicing in Boca Raton, Florida. So, hope you enjoy it. Here you go, Amy Effman. You were just telling me that this is unusual for you because you're usually on the other end of questions. You're not on the side where you're being asked. You're on the side where you're posing them, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Why is that? Tell us why that is.
So let's see. So a lot of my work is informed by the motto of staying curious. Mm-hmm. And so I find that as I meet with people who I have less in common with, my curiosity spikes, and I tend to ask a lot of questions while building rapport with clients or with people. And oftentimes, as I'm collaborating with other people with the intention of assisting them or guiding them, I provide very little self-disclosure. So this should be a little bit different.
Well, I want to make sure you're comfortable. So, you know,
yeah.
We won't push any limits there. You know, we both have boundaries, so
yeah,
we'll honor those. So how are you trained? You know, I can't remember. I must have known at one time. Are you a social worker or are you a mental health counselor?
Yeah. So I'm trained as a postmodern systemic family therapist.
Okay.
Which is a style in which we observe or look at an individual as part of a larger system and many various systems. So when working with an individual, part of this whole Stay Curious motto is designed by first assessing patterns that have existed in one's life, whether it be in their family system, their lifestyle system, if you will, financial systems that might be a part of their life, their religious system or spirituality system, the demographic from which they were raised or brought up, or maybe even if they were, let's say they were adopted by a culture in which they were not born into, how does that create change or patterns for their lifestyle and their choices currently? So by being trained as a postmodern systemic family therapist, the way I ask questions and the language choice that I use with people, and probably the way I've been trained to think, might be a little bit different than someone who is looking for, let's say, a diagnosis or a set of problems or kind of zoned in on maybe a singular goal. This would be a larger scale of thinking, more on the macro level. How is this person sitting in front of me? How have they arrived here?
Right.
What areas of their lives have been impacted by their choices, their thoughts, their emotions, and what can we tease out by asking good questions and creating some good, healthy conversation and dialogue back and forth? And part of my training, a lot of my training is solution focused and solution driven. So the focal point for my questions, once understanding where someone has been, is to not harp or dig on history. It's very much focused on the things we can change, which would look like redesigning the present and planning for the future, more so than spending hours, weeks, months, years on history, which is a lot different than other clinicians.
Yeah. You know, and I don't know, having done a lot of work myself, for me, I think some of the most progress I have made in being more who I want to be in the present and moving forward could only really happen when I was willing to really go deep and not like necessarily, I guess for me, it's been about experiencing the emotions that I repressed, you know, because until I could do that, they were still holding me back. So it's interesting. What comes up for me talking about this is that this world, I mean, everybody needs something different, right? There's kind of the crude way that I put it is there's a screw for every nut, but,
sure.
but every approach, I mean, there's not one approach that just is what the solution is for everybody. And,
correct.
And maybe I need Amy Effman at a certain point in my life, but later down the road, I need to be able to reflect and, you know, we change as time goes on. So,
sure.
So how long have you been practicing?
So my training went a little bit different than one's normal course of education and training. When I was much younger, my vision was to become an advocate for abused children in the law system and the legal system. And I became a guardian ad litem when I was 18 or 19 years old in Gainesville, Florida. And my intention and goal for my career path and my purpose, so I thought at that time, was to advocate for abused and neglected children. And as I continued to establish my life and my career, I found myself going in many different directions that sounded good, that kind of veered off the initial path to studying law and becoming an attorney to assist people who have been harmed by another person and taking and assisting in legal action or legal consequences for those actions. What I found was as I was intending to make those steps, I had different doors open and other doors closed for me. So it led me to studying first. I studied business undergrad, and then transitioned into my first graduate program, which was cross-cultural education and diversity, because I'm extremely culturally sensitive and appreciate, admire, and love diversity, and find that when working with people, I'm a heck of a lot more interested and curious about people that have little in common with me than I would someone who has a very similar upbringing or background. So what kind of started my formal education after my undergrad in business was my first master's degree in cross-cultural education and diversity, which led me to a whole different avenue and presented some life challenges around that time in my early 20s. And I was exposed to substance abuse in the addiction world early on. And having moved to San Diego at 20 to kind of explore and recreate myself in life, I found that I learned a lot about the people that were in my life and the way that their thinking worked and the way that their choices worked, and became extremely curious about studying substance abuse and addiction. And then I decided to study or further pursue my curiosity in addiction studies and substance abuse. So I was very young. I was probably 22, 23. At that point, my life had taken a turn.
Were you in San Diego? Is that?
Yep. I was in San Diego. I was, I had finished my first master's in cross-cultural education and diversity. And I found myself in a situation where I was very curious about the addicted mind, the addicted brain, through personal life experiences. And I started to study at UCSD to become a substance abuse counselor. And from that point moving forward, my whole direction in which I thought my career and my life would go took a massive shift. And I fell in love with the work and the science behind it. And primarily what I really fell for was this idea that families could reunite after pretty significant damage had occurred. And I was curious how I could become someone who could assist in the healing process for families that were in trouble, primarily because of substance abuse, alcoholism, and some of the awful things that come with that, abuse, trauma, incest, divorce, infidelity, et cetera, violence. So that really piqued my curiosity. So when it comes to my studies as a therapist, I did work it a little bit, I don't want to say backwards, but my initial interest was in substance abusers and the science around the addictive brain. And then it became something where I wanted to continue to study. And I kind of dipped my foot into a couple of different graduate programs at NYU, their social work program, Nova Southeastern, their marriage and family therapy program. I studied at UCSD to specialize in addiction. And also at Alliant International University, I studied marriage and family therapy. So I had been exposed to various styles of marriage and family therapy through different training programs. And then I finally completed my studies here in South Florida at Nova Southeastern in marriage and family therapy, where everything kind of was wrapped up between the first graduate work in diversity and cross-cultural education, which led me to the addiction studies and kind of specializing in substance abuse counseling in San Diego, and then transitioning into marriage and family therapy and completing my studies with that. But I spent a long time going to school, trying out different programs, making sure it was the right fit for me.
Mm. You know, one of the things that comes up often in this podcast is the kind of path that we take in life professionally, and how I'm not sure what it's like to be a young woman to go through this, but as a young man around 18, I felt a significant amount of pressure to like know what I was going to do with my life. And I really didn't. I mean, I had some ideas about what I wanted to do, but I was a confused kid, and I figured it out you know, eventually it all worked out and it was a nonlinear path. But I also kind of beat myself up for not being someone who knew exactly what I wanted to do with my life at like 14, 16, 18. And, you know, it's kind of crazy to expect that of oneself. Mm-hmm. And especially in this day and age when people, you know, change careers often more than once in the course of their professional life. But it took me a long time to be comfortable with the idea that I kind of feel my way through things and respond to things and respond to opportunities that I find. And that's really me. That's the way I am. You know, I'm not as concrete like some people are. And it's nice to hear someone talk about how, you know, you started in one place and you ended up somewhere completely different, yet you're happy with what came of it, right?
Sure. Very happy.
And they're all kind of like, even being the guardian ad litem and advocating for abused children. I mean, in a way, those are just all parts of the same thing, you know? Right? I mean, it's all tied together. Wouldn't you say?
Certainly it is. Yeah. In fact, I'm thinking as you were speaking, what really stands out for me are the words linear and nonlinear. Mm-hmm. And I think about causality. So a lot of the studies and a lot of the work that I've been doing, I find that there are many people that think if this, then that, if A, then B, or if A, or if A plus B, then C. And I find that when working with people and in looking at patterns and relationships and systems, oftentimes life is not linear. So this is a very good example of, I think you were relating to me in terms of my choices when it came to, I thought I was going to do this and then I landed here and then the outcome was really awesome, but maybe I was planning for this and something else showed up. So I think it's important when working with people, and just even when communicating with people, that sometimes things are so much different than we intend them to be or expect for them to be. I know that that's how I'm hearing you have, there's a similarity there with your path and your journey and mine, that perhaps
mine,
at one point.
Mine was probably a little messier than yours, but.
And that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it really is. I mean, it took what it took. And also, you know, if I hadn't had my experiences with addiction, my life wouldn't be what it is. I mean, and I'm pretty happy with the way it all turned out. I mean, it was tough for a little while, but and that's one of the things I talk to people about. I try to help young men see is that, you know, if you can just do this, you're going to look back on all this someday and it's going to make sense and you're going to be a better, stronger person for it. And this is actually an opportunity for you to be happier than you might have been otherwise, you know? So
it's
all
a great perspective.
Yeah. I mean, it all works together if we let it, you know, but it's hard to see that it is, especially
when you're in it
struggling. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Everything feels so permanent and it's painful, you know? So in your work, you know, the topic of this podcast being personal authenticity, where does that fit in to the work that you do through the family lens, through which you look, you know, and the systemic patterns that you're kind of looking for and trying to tease out? Where does authenticity come into all this? Where do you see it?
I think it's a pretty big theme for all of the way in which my work is informed comes from a position of authenticity. Because I think when pushing people to some level of discomfort, there has to be some trust that's built in. So when working with people, without disclosing too much about self, because I'm not very big on self-disclosure when it comes to working with a client who's come to you for guidance, I think that being authentic has a lot to do with how you show up. Your level of compassion, your level of motivation for change, their change, your excitement around positive things that are happening for them, and maybe this belief that kind of like you can see within them, you can see that good things can happen for them, maybe when they're out of hope.
Yeah.
Being able to look at someone and work with someone and truly feel hope for them and assist them or guide them and being able to see what I see. So I know an analogy that I use sometimes with clients is if they were driving, like through a rainstorm and they had the driver's seat and I'm in the passenger seat and they're driving, I believe a good clinician or a good therapist or even someone who assists in healing, whatever we want to call that person, would assist them or help them in kind of clearing this very foggy windshield so they can see the path for themselves. It's not for me as a passenger to tell them what they should be seeing or to guide them and giving them instructions how they should be because I don't know how they should be. And I also take a non-expert position. I don't know you better than you know you. You've known you for, let's say, 28 years. I've known you for, let's say, 28 minutes. I'm not going to come in and speak down to or directly confront someone about something that they might know better than I know, but to work with them and to have a collaborative approach. Or another form of therapy that I really enjoy using is narrative therapy, where you rewrite the story of your life, you recreate it, you identify the characters in which you choose to take with you, you tease out exceptions to the problem. So when someone comes to see you and they tell you about depression or anxiety or something that they believe has always been a factor that's interfering with their life, we might look for exceptions or point out exceptions or spend more time talking about exceptions to times in their lives when they were able to have X, Y, Z and that quote unquote problem did not exist. What were you doing during that time? What made you happy during that time? So I think your initial question to tie it back around was about authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
How do I work from a lens or through framework of authenticity? I think people understand that when I'm working with them, they can read, they can feel the level of compassion and admiration for
their struggle. Does that work?
Not so much their struggle, but their ability to think that there's better out there, their ability to give it one more chance, especially working with substance dependent people. People that are chronic relapsers, I find, have an abundance of resilience. What is it that, where are they finding the strength to give this a 14th, chance
right,
and making
right.
their life better?
Right.
If I fail at something 13 times, which I don't really like the word fail, but if I don't get the outcome that I'm seeking 13 times and my family has now, given up on my approach and my friends have kind of walked away and I've had constant problems after problem after problem, one might get pretty worn out. But the people that continue to show up and ask for help and that are like available for suggestions, I find to be completely resilient and fascinating people. These are the people I wish to work with. So I think that authenticity kind of shines through your work when you have genuine compassion, when you believe in somebody that you're guiding or helping, when you ask valuable questions, when you feel understood and when you feel heard. And by constantly giving reinforcement that there are things that, although maybe someone has done a slew of things that are not great in their life, that there's a reason why they're here today. And that they can recreate purpose, they can recreate their identity and find themselves and find meaning.
And it, essentially, you're believing in them when they may not
yes.
be able to do that.
I do not feel that I'd be a productive clinician, therapist, healer, helper, person if I didn't first believe in my craft, if you will, believe in what I was saying or doing or practicing.
Right. Okay. So that's authenticity from your position, which is great because, I mean, in addition to being the way to really connect with someone, being real, you're modeling something for them too, which really is more effective than anything you could tell them, right? You know, I mean, it's like people, I think, I mean, what we do, how we act, what is observable in us speaks so much more loudly than anything we could really say.
Sure. And people are a lot more receptive to working together and coming up with their own solutions than me directing. You know, they, when we talk about like, when people are reminded of a mother, a sister, an ex-girlfriend, an ex-fiance, an ex-wife in a therapy session, it's completely counterproductive. So we have to be mindful of transference and countertransference. Mm-hmm. So this is something I'm constantly cautious about. Yeah. I might even ask if I'm noticing body language or if I'm noticing that someone's kind of taken a step back or feels uncomfortable with maybe a question or something that I've just posed. I would want to kind of take a look at what's my role in their response. Mm-hmm. You know, what's my contribution to a specific response and kind of maybe just check in with them.
Yeah.
So oftentimes after I've worked with somebody, they appear very motivated to want to continue to work together as mm-hmm. opposed to this being kind of an uncomfortable,
being prodded, picked,
exactly.
picked at, yeah.
picked at, or talked down to, God forbid, feeling judged. Yeah. That
well,
would be
and
the
I think when people are resistant to therapy, that's, you know, really, they don't want to be picked apart. I think that's it. Yeah. A lot of times they don't want to be scrutinized.
Sure. And in doing so, I think I've mentioned many times, I ask questions. I'm not very direct until I've built some rapport with a client. And I ask kind of valuable questions for them to think and then for them to say, oh, wow, yeah, maybe I was part of the problem. So yeah. I might ask in a situation which would be relational or systemic about one's contribution to mom cutting me off, to my boyfriend's walking out on me, to my friends leaving me at the bar without saying, you know, were you blackout drunk and provocative and all over your friend's boyfriend, I might ask, what was your contribution to the friendship dissolving? And they might look at me like, what are you asking me? What are you talking about? What's your contribution? Or maybe if someone cheated, I might ask them what the cheater's contribution was to the failure of their relationship. Kind of ask questions that might be outside of the box, yeah. make them kind of pause and think, oh, wait a minute, what is she asking?
Yeah. Well, you know, and that's part of it, right? Just helping people see things from a different angle. Mm-hmm. And you know, I like what I'm hearing from you is that what I believe is that people have the ability to heal themselves. And, you know, the part of the therapist, the helper, or whoever, the healer, is to just support them in that and steer them in the right direction and believe in them and, you know, challenge them when they're trusted and, you know, I mean, but essentially I believe we all have it within us, you know, and it goes back to what you were saying a little bit ago, when you can see things in clients that they can't necessarily see in themselves. Mm-hmm. I've had a situation with this client in a group that I do that's been coming up, you know, there's a decision he needs to make that he's resisting making. He knows he needs to make it. It's a difficult decision to make. It's something he's going to grieve. He knows he needs to do it, but his the way he explains it is, I can't. I know I need to do it, but I just can't. And you can tell the way he says it, he's just said it to himself for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And he says it, you know, with shame in his eyes. And I just looked at him and, you know, I know you don't think you can, but you can. Like, I know you can. You can sure. do it. And I, you know, I'm not just saying that, like, of course he can like break up with his girlfriend, like, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, But it's so easy. The negative self-talk is so corrosive to us. That's a huge barrier to get past, right? I mean, but really what I wanted, back to the authenticity thing. So in terms of the person in the other chair, where do you think personal authenticity fits in with the client and their process of healing? What's your take on all that?
When it comes to the client's authenticity or the provider or the clinician speaking to them?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that a conclusion that I've come to, and part of the reason why I wanted to do this podcast on authenticity is because, you know, if I really go back and look at every decision that I've made that harmed me in some way, I mean, I compromised myself in one way or another. I wasn't true to myself. I was inauthentic somewhere, you know, either I wasn't, I engaged in a job I didn't really want or a relationship that was less than I deserved or whatever, you know, there's always a betrayal of self, I think, on some level. And I feel like addiction in a big way, I mean, it's just a person at war with him or herself, you know? So how do you get through that to the authentic person who, you know, where make peace, where the person can make peace with him or herself and be who he or she is?
I would want to understand what's blocking that. I think when we talk about authenticity, in an effort for someone to truly love and admire themselves and feel good about their decision-making, they have to be in a position where they do feel confident. They do have things that they can look at themselves and think, I'm good enough to make a decision, regardless of what others might think, or regardless of things that people have done to me in the past, or things that people have said to me in the past, the way I've been treated in the past, I still feel a specific way about myself and I deserve X, Y, Z. So I think you had provided a great example about someone you've worked with that has a lot of hesitation or resistance about getting out of, it sounds like, a dysfunctional relationship or connection, whether the relationship be an intimate relationship, a family relationship, and a, you know, an employment situation.
Could be a friendship or anything.
Even a friendship. Sure. So if one appreciates and values themselves enough and they feel good about themselves, I think at that point, they have to ask themselves, do I deserve this treatment? And if I don't deserve this treatment, why do I believe I don't deserve this treatment? And that's a lot of the stuff that I really enjoy talking to people about as they're looking at both healthy and unhealthy relationships, whether they're in them, trying to get out of them, or they have successfully disconnected from them. My curiosity would be, what are some of the things that you feel you deserve in a healthy relationship? And then if I'm working with someone, especially addicts and alcoholics, that don't feel they deserve X, Y, and Z, that's really when curiosity kind of runs wild. Which patterns, which people, which experiences, which traumas have led you to believe that you don't deserve a relationship that offers X, Y, Z, whatever that might be? And then we can start working on those things.
Yeah.
Right. So that's a really great way, instead of saying, you know, so why are you here in therapy today? Oh, well, you know, I'm having a difficult time with my girlfriend. Tell me more about that. And I'm really less concerned about the girlfriend. I want to know more about that person, right? The individual, you know, the customer of change. They're actively seeking help. For what reason? What's been their motivating factor? So I would like to know, if somebody is feeling their very best and they feel that they can plot out or map or identify the things that they deserve in healthy dynamics, for what reason would they be willing or feel that it's fair for them to accept less than what they deserve?
Right. And when you see that a person is accepting less than they deserve, you see that as an opportunity to kind of, you know, pose questions that lead you to a better understanding of that
person. What led them?
Right.
Sure. not only that person, but why is it that they feel the way they feel about themselves? Mm-hmm. Could it be, I know a lot of people I work with talk about pretty traumatic past relationships, history of physical abuse, emotional blackmail. Why does one not feel, why would one be willing to sell out on themselves to accommodate a relationship that doesn't serve them?
Well, you know, one of the things I sort of a general belief that I have about people is that, you know, whatever brand of dysfunction you kind of grow up in, and we, I think for the most part, all of us have something. That's what is normal to us. That's what's most comfortable to us. So then we feel most comfortable with that. So when we choose partners, like if we were emotionally abused, then it doesn't necessarily feel like foreign to be with somebody who talks down to us, you know, it kind of feels comfortable. And it also might feel kind of weird to be around someone who's really, really good to us, you know, and until we heal, you know, it's like, and it goes back to the patterns, the family patterns, because I don't know. I mean, I believe that when you asked, why is it that a person would accept less than they deserve? I think, do you find that it is somewhere in the family story, some sort
of
pattern?
Sometimes, not always. Well, let me backtrack there. So sometimes that happens, where there were repeating history, right? This is where the patterns are pretty interesting. So when I meet with someone, for whatever reason I meet with them, whether it's a DUI, it's just a client who wants to come in and work on stressors, et cetera, et cetera. A substance abuse problem, I always start with a family genogram with the intention of looking at patterns that exist. Mm-hmm. And so some people find it kind of bizarre that during the first session, I seem to be like kind of drawing things on a piece of paper the whole time we're meeting. What is she doing? Why is she writing stuff down? Right. And I do a very good job at explaining to them what I'm going to be doing while they're talking to me. Yeah. So I can kind of highlight to them some of the things that I understood them saying at the end. And they really like at the end, they say, wow, you were listening to like every detail. Right. Wasn't sure what you were doing. And I noticed you were writing a bunch of stuff down, but I show them what the family genogram looks like. And it's pretty messy and sloppy. But for me, it shows a lot of different dynamics that exist, patterns, even if they're patterns of unhealthy friendships, unhealthy work experiences, an abundance of different employers, getting fired several times, physical trauma, physical abuse. Does that then play into your current relationships? Are you on the receiving end? Are you a survivor? Are you a victim of it? Are you the perpetrator? So it's interesting to see kind of all of the dynamics and all of the patterns.
Have you ever done one for yourself?
Yes.
Yeah, yes. I have too.
So I think any good therapist, or I should say any person that's helping guide another person, should really take a look at self-inventory and take some of their own suggestions and questions and invitations. I call my writing assignments invitations, but have a look at those things before asking others.
Let me invite you to take a deep, hard, deep look at yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. So that is a part of my first session is I invite people to tell me, who is that guy? How would you describe that guy to me in third person?
Hmm.
And yeah. So that is a really uncomfortable invitation for
That's
many
a tough
people.
One, right? Can
and then, of course, they're invited to do some more work beyond that, which would look like, so once we've discovered or identified who is that person, who would you like to become? And how will you know when you've become him or her? What signs will indicate that you've made change? And gosh, who wants to talk about those?
You know
answers?
What, Amy? You sound like a really great therapist.
Well, I appreciate it.
I mean it.
But it's
no,
fun. It doesn't
I mean,
even sound like therapy. Who wouldn't want to know this information about themselves?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, these sound like fun questions.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and you know, when I say that kind of jokingly, I mean, I already knew you were, but it's also
well,
nice
thank you.
To, to kind of learn a little bit more about you and your approach. And
thank you. I get very excited about this stuff.
Well, and
I find it so satisfying to see other people get better and get excited about who they are and who they can become.
Well, and I've done the Genogram thing. I mean, I did it years and years ago with a therapist a long time ago, very early on in my recovery. But then also not all that long ago in adult children of alcoholic and dysfunctional families, which, you know, is like deep, deep work, that 12-step program. I mean, it's I was so happy to find it and see what it was like and see the work. But, you know, the first step in ACA is part of it is a Genogram. And
it's incredible.
And they basically, you know, use this shape for that or whatever, you know, and I kind of went all out and got a big poster board. Yep. First of all, I'm the youngest of 8 kids, so I have an enormous family.
Wow. Is that awesome?
Yeah. So, but I went all out, and I mean, I use crayons and, you know, color coded stuff and you know, what was really comforting to me about it is that after I did it, I could look at it. I mean, and once I got past, wow, that's crazy. There's an awful lot of stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I had this feeling of, wow, you know, it really would have been impossible for me to not be an alcoholic given the circumstances. I mean, wow. And also I survived all that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was comforting and reassuring and in addition to a little troubling. You know, but, you know, when you're a person, like, you're willing to do that kind of stuff, I mean, you're in, you're ready to, like,
sure,
you know, take a deep
breath. Well, imagine this, just as a person is describing themselves as a survivor, mm-hmm. as like, I think the significance of language is so important. Today I wake up and I am a survivor, but that is a totally different attitude, perception, energy, title. It's a whole different message than,
I'm hurt. I'm broken.
I'm a victim. I'm broken. I'm a garbage pail.
Yeah.
I'm a loser. I've screwed up everything in my life. I've harmed everyone I've been with. I've cheated on all my girlfriends. I've been cheated on by every boyfriend. I think that language is powerful.
Yeah.
It's almost like an invitation to allow history to repeat itself, but history doesn't have to repeat itself.
Well, the other, you know, and I a lot of times describe this stuff for people in crude ways because I'm not a brain person or, you know, I don't know a lot of the science behind stuff, but I'm a big believer in mantras. Right. And what really kind of sold me on it is I remember I was traveling for work. I was at like this departmental retreat up in Tennessee for this company I was working for. And I took a little like Eastern meditation book with me. It was like Yogananda. It was just, I think it's called Scientific Healing Affirmations or something like that. And, you know, I've never really been much of the look in the mirror and say, you're good enough, you're smart enough, and doggone it, people like me. And
people like me.
You know, I mean, I never, that just always felt kind of lame to me. But I'm flipping through this book one night after we kind of broke up and at the meeting. And I find this mantra that he's suggesting that you repeat. And it was every day and in every way, I'm getting better and better.
Mm.
And so, you know, I started using it. And
I love that.
At some point, I started kind of morphing it into things that were maybe a little more specific to me. But I think, like, I relate it to the Robert Frost poem, The Road Not Taken. You know, well, there's the one road that's, you know, each step is trodden black, and then there's the other one that's overgrown with brush. if we're so used to, in terms of, you know, the messaging in our brain, if we're so used to beating ourselves up, I mean, the cleared path is going to be you're a piece of shit. You're stupid. That's the cleared path. And to me, you know, it's kind of like we got to clear the other path.
Sure.
And that's what, to me, that's the value of a mantra. And, you know, I mean, Amy, that every day and in every way I'm getting better and better. Go say that 50 times and tell me you don't feel better. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just, it works.
Or for those that, and this is kind of where that diversity piece comes in, for those that don't like saying that or writing that, write a rap about what that means to you. Every day and in every way I'm getting better. Write a rap about it. Write a poem about it. Write a letter to self.
Right.
Sing me a song. Play me something on the guitar that indicates that in every day and every way I'm getting better. Show me what that looks like, sounds like, tastes like, feels like.
Yeah.
Create that experience. Allow that possibility to exist.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes people have not been exposed to that possibility even being an option.
Yeah.
So how do we create that option?
But
that,
you know,
option should exist.
You're right, though. I mean, I'm really in complete agreement with you about the power of words, and especially being someone who writes. I mean, I'm pretty, a lot of times, I mean, I'm careful about like not putting things on paper that sure. I don't want to be out there forever, you know, or even texting or whatever, you know. I'll pick up the phone and talk because.
Sure. You know, well, that's smart.
Yeah. Well, and I'm not talking about anything crazy, but, you know, just, anything sensitive and or anything I'm not really sure about. That's the other thing, you know. I mean, there's a quote from a book that I've been reading that it's something like words in granite are forever, you know, something like that. Like they're, you know, words don't go anywhere. I mean, they don't when they're published, like. And they really are powerful. And the things that we say to ourselves, the things that we say to other people, it really does matter. And just the practice of beginning to evaluate that, what do I say to myself? And what are the expressions I use with other people? I mean, I've actually gotten to the point where when I hear people say certain things about themselves, like calling themselves stupid, or it kind of hurts, you know. Mm-hmm. it's like committing an act of violence on yourself. It just kind of breaks my heart to hear someone be that hard on themselves. And I'm usually pretty consistent about saying, you know, don't talk to yourself that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, so, and people don't always want to hear, in our culture, people will slough it off like, well, you know, I don't really think I'm stupid. Well, you know, you'd probably feel a lot smarter if you didn't say you were stupid.
That's right.
1,000 times.
Or maybe one can ask themselves, if they hear someone saying, I'm stupid. Well, what else are you?
Right.
What else are you? Right.
Yeah.
Kind of inviting. Okay. So if we want to reserve this idea of you being stupid, what other things are you?
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to people that, again, are very resilient. You say you're stupid, but despite thinking you're stupid, you're back in treatment trying to do better for yourself. Is that also true?
Oh, well, yeah, that's also, you know, true. With the negative self-talk and the mm-hmm. and all that, I mean, they're living life with one arm tied behind their back.
Totally.
They're still surviving, you know? So, mm-hmm. so what's down the road for you? You have any big goals or anything that you want to talk about?
Well, I just created a new LLC, a partnership LLC with a few colleagues called the Counseling Collective. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, the intention and the goal is to create a larger group of clinicians that have a variety of different skill sets and strengths, and really provide some guidance and supervision for, I guess, the industry, if you will. So hopefully take on some 1099 contractors and some registered interns, and work to assist other therapists and clinicians that are becoming licensed and eager to find kind of a collaborative group. So that's a pretty exciting thing.
I like that.
I've also been doing some writing and some speaking here and there. Usually it's when treatment facilities I consult with or I'm associated with ask me to speak on a specific topic. And I really, really enjoy that. And then in the past, I would teach classes that would help guide clinicians or addictions professionals or addictions counselors in their certifications and understanding kind of family systems and understanding the addiction model and how we treat substance abuse treatment from a different lens, kind of like from a postmodern systemic lens. So I've done some work in, you know, graduate programs and also in the certified addictions programs for BHTs and also for CAPS. And I love working with people that are studying to become therapists and counselors and healers and behavioral health techs and everything else. But these days where I've been challenged is just kind of like writing articles for the legal system and some court, various things for court. So I do a lot of assessments and evaluations for individuals who get DUIs, maybe stalking cases, violent offenses with anger management. I also help people who are trying to gain custody back of their children and work with people with domestic violence and divorce and family matters because of alcohol or drugs. So I really like getting involved with that. And I've been doing some work around individuals with high net worth. Mm-hmm. So one of the programs I consult with in Tequesta, Florida, has a program for executives that would probably not be willing to go to a traditional treatment center with a traditional program. Mm-hmm. And so that's been really kind of fascinating, working with people who have had a different set of consequences, but have maybe never been affected financially or in their business for having a drug or alcohol problem or a mental health problem. And so it's interesting to see how their lives take a turn when they are confronted with a spouse maybe walking out, adult child telling them that they're done with them.
Or a board of directors saying we're going to fire
board of directors or major medical consequences. That's typically what we see. But doing a lot of work with that. So helping financial planners and trust attorneys, estate attorneys, kind of navigate what that looks like for people that have excess resources and cash, how we can best help people that sometimes don't have financial consequences.
Hmm.
So another area of interest for me.
So would you say you're doing what you're born to do?
I love what I'm doing. Yeah. I love what I'm doing in a totally amazing world. I think what I would love to have is something kind of like in the movie Annie, where there was this home with tons of kids and be able to have kind of like a really positive and healthy and happy orphanage for lots of kids. But that I don't think is realistic these days for me in kind of my lifestyle. But definitely trying to serve as many people and trying to offer a new approach or a new way for other people that work with people that are suffering that is non-judgmental, non-confrontational if possible, and a way of kind of like spreading love and curiosity as opposed to kind of heavy confrontational models.
Yeah.
It's not really my style. That is not my style.
Well, and you know, I mean, having worked in this world for a long time, the older I get, the kind of further along the path that I get, you know, to me, it's becomes increasingly apparent that it's about showing up in a loving, supportive way for people. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's about giving love. It really sure. is. And it's just a certain form of it. It's a certain expression of it, but that's really what it is. And I like your idea about the orphanage thing. You know,
that'd be incredible.
One of the observations I have about the addiction treatment industry is that, you know, if you go through the biopsychosocial histories of all the clients at all of these facilities, I mean, there are a lot of adoptees. And I think most of the time it's just kind of parsed out as something to deal with later, or it's not directly addressed. And it's a primal wound that I just think it's overlooked a lot. And also not really well understood in our culture all that well. You know, we kind of do this thing with adopted kids. Well, lucky you, you got adopted. Well, another way to look at that is you suffered the worst loss you possibly could at birth.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a super sensitive topic for me. I don't know why, but I've always told myself if I went back for my doctorate, that would be my area of focus. Mm-hmm. Would be the correlation between adoption and addiction.
Yeah.
And I've noticed that I gravitate towards people in my life that have been, let's call it survivors of adoption. Mm-hmm. I find it pretty fascinating. Some with an extensive addiction history, some without, mm-hmm. but I find it completely fascinating, specifically around like the attachment model and, yeah. and what comes next yeah. and what does family mean to me? What does a spouse mean to me?
Yeah. yeah. And, you know, so, I like had a serious relationship with someone who was a foreign adoptee, one of my more recent romantic relationships. And, you know, I loved her. So I learned about that and went out of my way to like try to understand it. And that didn't work out, you know, I mean, but it was a great learning experience. And then what I began to find professionally is these guys kept showing up in front of me, like foreign adoptees and with these wounds. And so I was able to take that I learned personally and show up for them in a way that, you know, nobody really ever had before.
That's right.
And it's huge. It's huge.
It's huge.
And the attachment implications of that are just enormous. And it's you know, it kind of just makes you question everything. And of course, I mean, I have other adoptees in my life. Everybody deals with it in a different way and has different beliefs about it and stuff. But, you know, that correlation between that and addiction is really interesting. It is and significant. And when you were talking about the orphanage thing, I mean, one of the things I've thought about, I really hope that as a society, and I feel like we're becoming better and more open about healing and all this stuff that you and I are talking about, that the society is becoming more open. But I think, you know, honoring grief and loss, you know, giving ourselves time to mourn, like we're not great at that stuff. And I always thought it would be cool for there to be a place like a big house or something. I envision like a beautiful place with gardens where, you know, there's not necessarily something going on all the time. But if, you know, you lost the love of your life, if you just went through a tragic divorce and you need to go somewhere for a month and mourn and be supported and be shown love and have like, I just feel like that's something that would be really great.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I mean, there are lots of little things that could be done differently. But I really think going back to the beginning of our conversation, coming from a curious place is really, really important. And trying to understand people rather than taking a position that I know more than you do and you need to listen. I mean, it just, I just disagree.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, you know, we all need to be heard.
Yes.
You know,
how could we expect that someone could even help guide us or help understand us if we're not feeling as though we're heard?
Yeah.
So I completely agree.
Yeah. So, all right. So you didn't really answer the question directly. Are you doing what you're born to do? But it sounds like if you're not yet, you're on your way.
Oh, yes.
For sure.
I am okay. Certainly doing what I was born to do okay. Without question.
Well, and you know, I mean, just being able to work with you a little bit over the last few years, it's, you know, you have such a bright personality and it's and a warmth and you're fun. I mean, it's something that, you know, people are hurting really need that on top Thank of you. Understanding and being curious. I mean, you actually shine light on them too. You know, you're a bright light. So yeah.
Thank awesome. You. It means a lot to me.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. So, all right. So looking back on the life of my therapist, Amy at mytherapistamy.com.
Yes.
If there was a time in your life when, you know, the younger Amy needed some support or a word of advice, you know, when was that? And what would you go back and say to her?
When was that? When did that thought, fear, insecurity initiate? When did it begin?
Well, when was the time when maybe you were suffering in some way, you were hurting and you needed?
Okay. When was the time and what did I do? Or when was
What time? Would you go back and say to her?
Ah, thank you. I think this too shall pass. I find that in very difficult times, I hear myself out loud, verbally saying the Serenity Prayer. Mm-hmm. And knowing that certain things are out of my control in that very moment can be comforting to a degree. I also think that staying connected to nature is extremely important to me. Mm-hmm. Higher being, meditation, prayer, God, whatever we so choose, I find I gravitate towards that more when I'm in a position of massive uncertainty. And being around the ocean and in nature is really, it's helpful for me personally and has been on my journey. And then I think knowing that I can reach out for help, right? So no matter what position we're in life, if we're a clinician, if we're a therapist, if we're a doctor, if we're whatever we are in life, we are no different or better or than the people we serve. And therefore, we should take our own advice sometimes. And I think that would be the most important thing is that people are imperfect in life. Everybody makes mistakes. And that in times of need, it's important that anybody and everybody reach out for help and not to fear, you know, judgment. Working with somebody that may do the same things that you do for a living, but being open and flexible and vulnerable to getting support.
Well, you know, going back to the power of words, a couple things that stand out to me in one phrase, you know, that understanding that we're no better than those we serve. The we're no better part, I mean, should be obvious, but we forget. But what I like even more is those we serve, because that's what we're doing.
Sure. It's a blessing for, and without getting into a religious piece, it's a blessing when we have new people, when we have people in general reach out to us and allow us to help guide, ask questions, support them, love them. Teach them how to love themselves. Yeah. It's not, to me, nothing about it is work, especially with, you know, over the years that most of my businesses were referral by word of mouth. Mm-hmm. So if I have a client who I've helped or a couple or a family I've helped, and now they're referring their friends who are in crisis, there's no better compliment to me, but the only way I can serve, the only way that this would make sense to me is I can provide them the same level of service that I've provided to the friend that referred me.
Yeah.
Guidance, support, whatever it is.
Well, and it's, so, you know, yeah. To me, it's like one of the things that always kind of makes me feel funny is when people thank me for, oh my God, you just like, as if I went above and beyond or something like that. And I really just, I have this feeling like, yeah, this is just what you do. This is what I do. Like, it's not, you don't have to thank me. Like, you know, you're a mother whose son is killing himself slowly and you need yep. help. I mean, of course I'm going to help you, you know? But we're also like that life preserver for, you know, people are reaching out, they're drowning and they're reaching out. They need it so badly. And they, you know, the families too, they just need love and support too. And one of the things I've come to enjoy over the years, I mean, I might even like working with parents and families more than I like working with clients. I mean, I really, I love the time on the phone that I spend with moms and dads and, helping them just kind of have a little bit better understanding of what's going on. You know, I've had the alcoholism thing, you know, in the 12-step experience. I've done that work myself. I'm a counselor. I've worked in treatment facilities. I know how those systems work, you know, and can kind of translate for them the things that they hear from admissions departments or whatever. You know, I can just help them navigate all of this stuff. And it's pretty confusing.
Mm-hmm.
It is. And I think, you know, sometimes if a family just like they're Googling looking for treatments, they could end up anywhere. They could really end up anywhere, and anywhere they call, they're going to say, oh yeah, we're the place for you or your kid or whatever. Like they're not right. going to say we're not the place. Sure. Most places aren't. The better places will. But, so yeah, a lot of the work that I've been doing lately is with families who just have a kid and they don't know what to do.
That's exactly right. And no instructions come with it. But the damage that some families create on the kid is.
Yeah. Yeah. And that at that
becomes
point,
a challenge for just, us later in life.
For me at that point, that stuff's just got to kind of be tabled.
Mm-hmm.
But I can be there and hear the parents express their regrets or whatever, you know. But right now we just got to focus on getting him where he needs to be, you know.
That's right. That's right.
And I like that a lot. I like doing that kind of stuff. And I like, I've always taken seriously, especially working in our market where we are, that I've always felt like, I have a duty to sort of protect families, you know, look out for them and make sure that they get the care that they need, even if it's not me or my people providing it, but make sure they're pointed in the right direction. And always a lot of times I'll say, you know, even if this isn't for you, you know, you can still call me. And if, and if you have questions about anything you're hearing at wherever you call me, you know, I can help you. And it's going back to what you were saying a few minutes ago. I mean, it's really an honor to me. The way I look at it is to be in a position to be present for people at the most painful, critical times in their lives when they need to make this monumental change. It's an honor. I mean, it's such like a recreation of life that's taken place. And we get to be there and witness it and support them through it. It's pretty amazing.
It is. Yeah. Certainly amazing.
So, well, this has been fun, Amy.
Yes, I really appreciate you allowing me to be a part of this.
Oh, well, I appreciate you taking the time. And are you comfortable with your level of self-disclosure here?
Yes, I am.
All right.
there you go. Another episode in the books. Thanks for listening. You can learn more about the show and this episode's guest at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you enjoy this episode, please share it with someone. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every little bit helps. I want to thank the band Punk Rock Opera, whose music you hear throughout the show. Their songs are used with permission from the artist and under a Creative Commons license. If you're so inclined, check out the Patreon community. As soon as I do these interviews, I upload them to Patreon, where the content is only available to patrons and for just a couple bucks a month. I usually post audio content there, exclusive audio content, probably 8 times a month, if not more. And as these new episodes are released, as soon as they're done, they're available to patrons. So sometimes that might be 2 weeks before an episode is released, or even longer. Usually it's a few days. Anyway, if you want to support the show, that's a great way to do it. So thanks again for investing your time. It's a big deal to me. Thank you for supporting me and supporting the show. I hope you keep coming back. Be nice.
That's our story. I hope you enjoyed the punk rock opera. We have one last piece of music for you. It goes like this.
Okay, go. with bloody hands. The rage that's instilled in us can feed a crowd.
Thank you. Good night.